Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, King.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Well, thank you so much, Audrey. Thank you so much. We could not do it without you. We say that every week. I hope I say that every week. And Haley's back with another episode of the Jumble Justice Radio Show. It's kind of like a dog heading for the feed box, right? I come up every Thursday night. No, there's no World Series game tonight, right? So we probably have maybe 12 or 14 listeners. I'm kidding. I'm your host, Keith Haley. If this is the first time you've showed up, I've been doing this for a few years. We want to thank Johnny Cash for singing that nice song for us. I always think about Johnny Cash hitchhiking, getting up in that truck. That's certainly one of the safest folks probably to hitchhike with. But can you imagine hitchhiking today? Back in the Ice Age, I used to hitchhike, I mean, across states down to North Carolina and places like that. Whoa. I don't know. I'd have to check up on that and see how many crimes are associated with that kind of thing. But I don't think I want to do that outside of Appalachia or some other place where Oklahoma, where they got kind people. But other states do too. But, you know, crime is all over the place, and it's mobile now more than it used to be. It's not more. It's just more more mobile. But anyway, thank you, Audrey, for getting us on. I want to thank Mike and Lucy also, who are doing research for us tonight, events and developments. And that's always difficult and interesting and sometimes humorous practice of criminal justice. And we're getting a lot of stories today. By the way, I'm not going to comment on the news segment either on the Ferguson case, which these grand jury leaks are coming out. You know, seems like they're in favor of the police officer, or what that went on in Canada. You've been given minute-by-minute updates on that, or over updates on that on your TV and your radios for quite a while. But isn't it amazing that Sergeant of Arms, that's what they call him, the guy that spent 30 years in the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, who killed that intruder yesterday in their parliament. Just incredible. I mean, we pass the word hero around a lot, but I think that's the name for this guy. And he spent 30 years, I think he was 67 years old or something like that. I'm not an ageist, so don't accuse me of that. But it's remarkable that he did that. So you're listening to Blog Talk Radio, and I just always want to say that we want to thank the founder of this, Alan Levy. He's the CTO of BTR, and we want you to realize that you, any other person, any interest group, any organization, you can have your own Blog Talk Radio show broadcasting worldwide worldwide. Did you hear that? And streaming audio over the internet and to an unlimited number of listeners. Isn't that incredible? And it's absolutely free. It's absolutely free, and I think you can do, I checked this out, I think you can do up to 14 hours a week of broadcasting and not pay a penny. If somebody woke up, passed away in 1970s or 80s, they wouldn't believe this, would they? But just incredible. Radio used to be some kind of thing. And you heard me say it, I like radio because I can see the pictures better than television. Think about what that means. All right, tonight's show is going to be interesting. I think so. We're going to listen to Sylvia Longmire, and she is a retired Air Force captain, and she's a former agent with the Air Force Office of Special Investigations. And she's author of the book Cartel, but the book she's going to be talking about tonight in the issue, she gets the other gentleman here takes a little more time than I would have liked. I would like to hear a little more, but this is on booktv.org. You can listen to it, and that's, remember what Book TV is for. It's for university faculty members who don't read books but want to act like they do. So you can hear the author present their book for, and it still amazes me, faculty I talk to that still do not know that Book TV exists, but they're glad to find out about it, and at least most of them are. But anyway, she's going to be discussing her book, Border Insecurity. Not security, border insecurity. And she takes a critical look at our border security and says that until the federal government makes border security a national priority, our borders will remain porous. And she's saying that, and she's saying it with authority, and she's researched it well. And you know this is probably in my top five favorite topics in the whole field of criminal justice and national security. I did go to the border. I won't elaborate on that. And looked around down there for a week or so and saw how porous it was. That was 10 years ago. And now, I don't even want to talk about what's going on now, but I will in some of the new segments here when we get to that. So anyway, let's go ahead and hear what our blonde joke is for tonight. Audrey has found us a good blonde joke, so I'll go ahead and read this one for us. And here's what it says. There was this bar, and in this bar, that's a place where you go and drink, there was a magic mirror. If you told a lie, the mirror would suck you in. So one day a brunette walks into this bar. Yeah. She walks up to the mirror and said, I think I'm the most beautiful woman in the world. And immediately the mirror sucked her in. The next day a redhead walks up into the bar. She walked up to the mirror and said, I think I'm the most beautiful woman in the world. And it sucked her in. Then the next day a blonde walks into the bar. She walks up to the mirror and said, I think, and it, she says, I think, and it sucked her in. I think, and it sucked her in. I like that one. She didn't know how to flip that out. All right. Thank you for finding that one for us. Let's have that. Anyway, I like that one. And we need a green tip, don't we, always? Because remember, the planet is wasting away. Those polar bears don't have any ice anymore to run. Oh, I think we found out that they do. It hasn't gotten any warmer, no matter the many ways we measure, since 1996. But anyway, here's one of Esma Floyd's from her book, 1001 Ways to Save the Planet. And she says, collect rainwater and use it to water your house plants and your garden. And I'm going to add to that and use it for everything else. You can drink it. You could bathe in it, right? You could wash your dog in it. So collect rainwater and use that to help keep our planet green. Aww. No, I'm serious. Okay, stop that. Okay, that's anyway, that's what we're going to do. Let's go ahead and play the Ohio Coalition's. I wonder if they changed their mind on this at all, but the Ohio Coalition's warning against having guns. Remember, for years now, we've been trying to help them. They're a coalition against firearms. And here's the message they have for us every week.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. a message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
You know, Ohio has a pretty good law concerning handguns. Kind of makes a difference of which sheriff's department you go to get yours. The sheriff's screen you for the license and that type of business. But if you get a renewal, some of these places will do it without appointment. You just walk in, you do it. Others, you got to get an appointment, and it takes 2 or 3 weeks or a month or whatever, but even a renewal. So anyway, remember that. Remember, 300,000 people a year use a firearm to ward off a felon. 97% of the time they don't shoot. They just take it out, and the criminal takes off. And sometimes they probably should have shot because it endangered their lives, but they didn't. They do it. But who wants to kill people? We don't want to do that. So anyway, let's go ahead and take a look at some of the news tonight and see what we got. We've got our green tip. We got the news. And here's the news we're going to talk about tonight. I like this one. I've got two articles on it. One is very long. I'll just refer a little bit to it after I go through this first one. But have you heard that more than 3,000 students at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill received credit for fake classes over an 18-year period as part of a program that allowed many of them to remain eligible to play sports, according to a report released yesterday? This investigation by former federal prosecutor Ken Weinstein is the latest of several attempts to unravel these allegations of academic fraud involving student athletes. He says this is a very complex organization that needed oversight at every step, and it didn't exist. And he says it's pretty shocking that it didn't exist. The report does not incriminate any coaches or athletic administrators in the scheme. Really? You're telling me for 18 years these guys didn't go to classes and got grades A and Bs? If they got Cs and Ds, those were later raised. The irregular classes at UNC Chapel Hill from 1993 to 2011 had no class attendance or faculty involvement. Can you believe that? Student athletes accounted for nearly half of those enrollments in the irregular classes, the report found. Among the non-athletes, many were struggling students who were referred through academic support services. Now, you're telling me that for 18 years, these people were doing nothing and getting A and B grades, and that wasn't a topic at conversation once in a while when the faculty and administrators and people go out to lunch? You got to be really sick to believe that, I think. You can't hear. The chancellor, Carol Folt, she says the bad actions of a few and the inaction of others failed the university's students, faculty, and alumni and undermined the institution as a whole. I would suggest that the chancellor get out of her office once in a while and walk around and go around and see what's going on in some of these classes. Anyway, here's a much longer article about it, and it gives you some of the incredible details. I won't go through all of those, but three groups of students she wanted to help the most were survivors of sexual assault, students with mental health issues, and unprepared athletes. And this one guy, they fired him. All these classes, by the way, came out of the department that inadvertently, of the Department of African American Studies. And some of these guys took these classes, so many of these classes, they found out that they inadvertently minored in African and Afro-American studies. Now, that faculty members quit. But don't you think if people are getting student aid from the federal government and this fraud is going on and they know it's going on, it doesn't take long for those. It said the majority of those in the know were academic advisors to men's basketball and football players who made up more than half of the athletes taking the courses. But knowledge of the course was not limited to these major men's programs. Others did it also, but just absolutely incredible. And University of North Carolina is certainly ashamed of that. Well, how about some more fraud? How about food stamp fraud? Here's an article about Ohio food stamp fraud. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it. So far in 2014, the department here in Ohio has sent letters to 5,478 cardholders who requested four or more replacement cards and notified departments about 91 people seeking 10 reissued cards. So I guess if you lose your card, you drop it, you can get another card, but guess what? The card still works, apparently. The public assistance service that feeds Ohio's hungry families can double as currency for drug dealers who will trade for almost anything. Dubious businesses and drug dealers will buy electronic benefits cards for about half the amount loaded on the card. From there, people who use the cash to buy drugs. That's part of the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, all SNAP, also known as food stamps. I won't go into this, but this happens in mostly Ohio's largest cities. The food stamp program has permanently disqualified 142 stores in Ohio over food stamp fraud, and who knows how many more there must be for say. But isn't that just absolutely incredible? This takes a little bit of time to go over, you know, if you have any time. But the changing face of America. If you want to look this up on the internet, it's called the U.S. Diversity Index. That talks about how things are changing in America. And way out in the country out there that used to have virtually no minorities represented, many Hispanics and others are moving into these places. So we're seeing a substantial change. And then President Obama is going to issue amnesty. He's turning loose serious criminals on their own, illegal aliens who are here, and they're supposed to come back for a trial or a hearing. You've heard about that. I'm not even going to comment on that today, but incredible. The White House intends to remain silent about their plans for immigration reform. But the immigration agency earlier this month, listen to this, had solicited a printer company able to handle a surge of 9 million green cards to support possible future immigration reform initiative requirements. Now, the company also is expected to produce up to 34 million cards, a figure representing an increase of the population of the United States by 10%. And many people think that President Obama, after this election is over, is going to just pass these things out like candy. I mean, it's just incredible, and who knows what these people have done. They are, stop me, please. I predicted it, and you heard me a year or so ago that when Colorado went legal with their marijuana, their medical marijuana, guess what? Would you believe that people are coming from all over the place in Colorado taking trips to get marijuana? Neighboring Oklahoma is a state where both medical and recreational marijuana is illegal. With little surprise to Oklahoma officials, Colorado marijuana has since made it to Oklahoma, and some done so with relative ease. This includes college campuses, prime targets for this new line of marijuana. We brought back tons, says one young female student at Oklahoma State. She said it was worth $400 worth she brought back. And now we've got Oregon and these other states are trying to legalize this, and it's going to be incredible. Colorado marijuana, they say it's making its way to Oklahoma after three consecutive years of decreases in the number of drug-related crimes on campuses. Well, boy, that's going to change, isn't it? You know, does anybody ever think that the people smoking this marijuana also drive cars, step out in front of automobiles, getting fights, I mean, on and on and on. You don't sit down and go to sleep necessarily. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens. Now, the only thing that will top that is this one. So who supports decriminalizing cocaine, heroin, LSD, methamphetamines, ecstasy, and all dangerous drugs and marijuana? No, it's not your teenage nephew. It's President Obama's new acting head of the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division. Her name is Vanita Gupta. In 2012, she wrote that states should decriminalize the simple possession of all drugs, particularly marijuana, and for small amounts of other drugs. Can you imagine what the United States would be like if that were possible? I mean, first of all, we've got alcohol to deal with, which sometimes is off the page in terms of dangers to people and loss of life. And she wants to legalize all drugs. Through her career, This 39-year-old woman, Ms. Gupta, has focused mainly on two things related to the criminal justice system. Mass incarceration, which has resulted in a bloated prison population, and second, the war on drugs. Well, she needs to study more, because well-done economic studies and crime deterrence and prevention studies show that locking up criminals lowers the crime rate. And as of, it's starting to change a little bit, but as of about 3 years ago and back about 4 or 5 years, we've had the lowest crime rates we've had in the history of the nation. And you know why? Because we're locking up the criminals. Not in the nation, but in a decade. And that's because we started locking these people up. But this woman wants to legalize all of the drugs. That takes too long to go through. But guess what's happening? The federal government is spending more than $2 million to develop wearable insoles and buttons that can track a person's weight in order to fight obesity. Maybe we could do it cheaper by just giving them a mirror, or possibly we could just not worry about how large they are or skinny they are, right? I mean, people are smarter than that, but a single device that can accurately monitor their body weight, their posture allocation, their physical activity, that is movement, and energy expender would be an extremely useful tool for weight management, the grant abstract states. Now, can you believe this? $1,334,397 for the project Smart Move so far has been expended. Then the University of Pittsburgh, they've been given $766,000 to develop the e-button. That's the idea that an accurate monitoring an overweight person's eating habits and physical activity levels will lead to a better understanding and fighting obesity. You know, I think these, don't these doctors have something else to do, these medical researchers? I mean, why do we care how big somebody else is? I don't care. I don't care at all. I mean, if they want to be big, be big. Who cares? This is one that's going to be all over the place, but we've got a woman in Virginia. An Augusta County woman faces a misdemeanor charge under Virginia's new revenge pornography law. Waynesburg police tell media outlets that 28-year-old Rachel Lynn Craig is accused of posting a nude photograph of another woman on Facebook. This law went into effect July 1st. I think they're the first one in the state and the nation to have this, and the phenomenon is called revenge porn. Police Sergeant Edwards there said that the 22-year-old victim told police that Craig took the photograph from a cell phone belonging to the woman's boyfriend and then posted it on Facebook. You know, an article I would like to write, a research project I'd like to do, is what social media has done relative to crime. In other words, how many crimes have been committed as acts of revenge and payback for revenge that's been posted on social media. I haven't seen anybody do anything like that. I could be missing. I'll look for it and let you know. But I'd like to do a study on that and see, because, I mean, anybody going to apply for a court job, a corrections job, a police job, federal, state, local, all of these people that are telling you get off of social media. People are saying things about you that you cannot even believe or know until they'll do some kind of search in their background investigation of you to get a job, and you'll come out as the worst person they've ever had, and they'll never even tell you and say goodbye. So anyway, that's enough of the news tonight. Give me time to get this set up. Well, we're going to be listening to a very good presentation. And what has happened with this, the border security issue is just, it's just come off the page. I mean, how do we know what's going on at the border? Like we say, well, illegal immigration is down. How do we know if it's illegal immigration, they're not passing through a gate and being counted, are they? But anyway, we're gonna listen to Sylvia Longmire, and she'll be joined by Chris Blatchford, that's how he pronounces it, or spells it, Blatchford, author of the book The Black Hand. I don't know anything about that one. And then an immigration reporter, Tim Pratt. And I admire a reporter that's focusing on this because it's hard to do. I did see some independent reporters when I was down on the Arizona border, but she'll be talking about this. Sylvia Longmire, and give me a second to get this set up, and I think you'll enjoy this. It's passing on things that we don't know.
Thanks, Jeff. It's great to have you all here with us tonight. You know, the thing I was thinking about the panel we have tonight, it's really like with two people, you guys are lucky you get like 10 people because the breadth of experience and the work that my colleagues have done is just remarkable. Sylvia Longmire and Chris Blatchford, between the two of them, Sylvia's worked with state, federal government, armed forces, worked outside of all those systems. Chris has worked in print and TV journalism. Both, of course, are authors. Sylvia, Border Insecurity and Cartel, and Chris has the book The Black Hand, all three of which will be available tonight, as I understand it. And, you know, both of them live where these issues are playing out in different parts of the country, Sylvia in Tucson and Chris in Southern California. So, again, between the two of them, we're really privileged to be able to benefit from the breadth of experience and have the good work they've done. And I look forward to hearing from them. And then we're going to talk amongst ourselves, and then at the end we would definitely welcome and appreciate your input and questions as well. So first, I think we'll hear from Sylvia.
Thank you very much for coming tonight. I can't emphasize enough how significant the current situation is in Mexico and also along the border. This is kind of an unprecedented situation as far as the way that Mexican drug cartels are operating south of the border, the measures that they're taking to bring illegal drugs into the United States, and also how it's impacting law enforcement, how it's impacting Americans across the United States, how it's impacting our national security. And
thanks, Jeff. Still dreamed of a better
Mexico and also along the border. This is kind of an unprecedented situation as far as the way that Mexican drug cartels are operating south of the border, the measures that they're taking to bring illegal drugs into the United States, and also how it's impacting law enforcement, how it's impacting Americans across the United States, how it's impacting our national security. And things that are occurring, particularly here in the United States, these are activities that are happening in our neighborhood. These are activities that are not just limited to California, Arizona, New Mexico, Texas. Drug cartels are providing 90% of the illegal drugs that are in demand. They're being used in the United States. That means that anywhere that people are using drugs or demanding drugs, you're going to find some kind of cartel presence. You're going to see, or you're actually not going to see the trucks, the cars, the people couriering all these drugs through our major highways, through cities like Atlanta, Las Vegas, Detroit, Chicago, St. Louis, Phoenix, Los Angeles. And all of this is happening right under our noses, yet it affects the very fabric of our communities, and I think that's worth learning a little bit more about what's happening. Now the big controversial issue is immigration, you know, immigration reform. I'm a contributing editor for Breitbart Texas, so we've been writing a lot about the surge in immigration that's been happening in South Texas, the families, the women, the children that are all coming because of the horrible security and economic situation in Central America. While that's happening, the cartels are taking advantage of that because they control the human smugglers, the coyotes, that are charging anywhere from $3,000 to $8,000 per person to bring them from Central America through Mexico to the border. So this is a situation that's affecting communities along the border, and then all those folks are looking for refuge throughout the country. So I think it's a topic worth becoming smart on. I think it affects not just folks along the border, but throughout the country. And I'm very appreciative that you're taking time out of your schedules to come and learn a little bit more about how these issues affect all of us.
Well, Sylvia is not only prettier than I am, she's smarter than I am. So forgive me, I'm going to work from some notes here a little bit. I'd like to start with an anecdote that I believe cuts right to the point as to why we're all here talking about cartels and organized crime today. And not that long ago, I was standing in a small apartment on Los Angeles' west side, and a Mexican woman in her late 30s named Teofila Rodriguez lived there with her only son. Now, her husband had been killed a year earlier when he was caught in a crossfire of some gang-related incident in Los Angeles. The family had come to America about 6 years earlier, like so many other immigrants, looking for a better way of life here. She worked all day in a clothing factory for minimum wage and still dreamed of a better life for her son, Rudy. His eighth-grade teacher was also in the room there with me and his mom. She told me that Rudy was a friendly, happy kid who always had a smile on his face. He loved sports, and like so many other American kids, dreamed someday that he would be a baseball major league pitcher. Now, Rudy's mother sat on the edge of her bed in the corner of the room while I was talking to the teacher, not because she didn't speak English, but because every time she started to speak, sobs clogged up her throat and choked back her words. And as I looked at her and saw those wet, red cheeks dripping with tears, I also saw my own mother, who lost a son at a younger age. I saw the faces of a trail of moms, grieving moms I'd interviewed during the past three decades in the Los Angeles area. And the faces of those moms were black and white and brown and Asian. And I couldn't help to note that the tears in their eyes were all the same color, and so was the pain in their heart. Her son Rudy wasn't in a gang. He had no tattoos, no baggy pants, no shaved head. He was simply walking home from school when gang members from another neighborhood jumped out of a car, chased him down an alley, shot him eight times, and left him for dead. Now, a neighbor came out and found him, his little body convulsing in the street. He died in the hospital about an hour later. Just a nice kid in the wrong place, the wrong time, caught up in some gang rivalry that he actually had nothing to do with at all. All his hopes and all his dreams as a kid died along with him. His mom, for the rest of her life, haunted by the senseless murder, left alone with her daily tears and broken hopes for what could have been. And she will live with that for the rest of her life. Now, what's even more heartbreaking is this. There are thousands of moms like her across the United States today. According to Wikipedia, as many as 15,000 people a year die in gang-related violence across the United States. Now, if that many people die each year from a certain disease, we would call it a national epidemic. And compare it to this figure. From the year 2003 to 2012, about 5,000 American soldiers were killed in the Iraqi War. 15,000 people on our streets in America in gang-related violence. In the Los Angeles area alone, going back to the 1980s, there have been roughly 500 to 1,000 gang-related deaths every year. Many of them, at least a third of them, the cops estimate, are just innocent people in the wrong place at the wrong time, like young Rudy. The FBI now reports in 1991 there were an estimated 250,000 gang members in the United States. Now, the FBI estimates there are about 1.4 million gang members in the United States and as many as 33,000 different gangs. The feds say about 70,000 of those gang members live in Los Angeles. I've seen other estimates up to about 120,000, and I tend to believe those more.
that arguably makes Los Angeles the gang capital of the United States. And those L.A. gangs have migrated across most of the country and into Mexico and into Central America. Now, the Mexican Mafia was founded in 1957. It started as a prison gang in California, and its influence has spread exponentially in the last 20 years. Now, Joe Morgan, the godfather of the Mexican Mafia, a man known as Peg Leg, had a relationship with a Mexican heroin kingpin back in the 1970s, but he was really about the only one. The organization as a whole was not that organized back then as it is today. Now, in the early 90s, a new generation of Mexican Mafia members, some refer to them as the Pepsi generation, clearly expanded their influence in California and also moved south of the border. At that time, in the early 90s, there were an estimated 50 to 60,000 gang members in Los Angeles. And the Mafioso enacted a plan at that time to unite all the Latino gang members under the Mexican Mafia umbrella. The plan was that all the gangs would not only buy their drugs from the Mexican Mafia, but it would also kick back part of the profits on all those drugs that they sold in the street. It gave the Mafia a virtual instant army of thousands of gangsters in Southern California working for them, selling drugs, doing hits, and extorting other drug dealers who weren't part of their program. Now, if a certain gang or a certain gang member didn't go along with this program, he was put on, or the gang was put on, what they call a green light list, which meant all the other Latin gangs in the Southern California area, if they ran into this guy or a member of this gang on the green light list, they were to kill them, and many of them were killed. Those street gang members then opened up markets throughout the western states, including Nevada, Texas, Arizona, New Mexico, Washington, Oregon, and Colorado. And most of those drugs they sell come from Mexico. Sylvia was saying this morning about they estimate 90% of the drugs now that come in the United States come through Mexico. The gang structure in L.A., already set up in neighborhoods all over Southern California, became like a bunch of McDonald's franchises for the Mexican cartels. In the early 90s, a San Diego area gang member named David Barone, they called him Popeye, developed a strong relationship with the Tijuana Mexican drug cartel run by the infamous Arellano Felix brothers. Popeye, based on his success as a Mexico top hitman for the cartels and running drugs back and forth across the border into San Diego, into Mexico, in 1992, he became what they call a made member of the California Mexican Mafia under the tutelage of another mafioso named Jose Marquez, better known as Bat Marquez. Now, these guys shipped tons of drugs across the border, and they left a trail of bodies, dozens of bodies behind. Among those bodies, the 1993 assassination of Catholic Cardinal Jesus Posados Ocampo, sitting in a limousine at a Guadalajara airport, and the 1997 ambush of a Tijuana newspaper man named Jesus Blancornelis, and a lineup of different Mexican police officials that were shot, assassinated in the streets. Now, federal wiretaps in 1994 recorded Bat Marquez at a meeting with other Mexican Mafia members in the Los Angeles area, bragging about his exploits, not in America, but across the border in Mexico, saying that he and Popeye Barone were like, and these were the words he used, like James Bond. That said, they had connections in Europe, Colombia. And gave them international influence, and that's where we are today. Boxer also noted that the Mexican Mafia controls all the prisons in California and most of the prisons in our federal system across the United States. And as the Mexican drug lords get locked up in those American prisons, the Mexican Mafia can have those cartel bosses either protected or killed. It gives the Mexican Mafia, our Mexican Mafia, tremendous influence over the drug cartel bosses in Mexico. Now, Barone was killed in a shootout in Tijuana, and Bat Marquez is now doing life in prison in America. But there is evidence that a number of other Mexican mafia heavyweights have taken their place, and that there is a symbiotic relationship now between the Mexican cartels and our Mexican mafia. It's a relationship investigators believe continues to thrive today all across the United States, and one that is cemented in drugs, dollars, deception, and death.
Thank you. We have, fortunately, a video that we can see, which is interesting because it makes some of the connections between the two subjects that Sylvia and Chris have just talked about. You consulted on this video, correct?
Yeah.
With National Geographic, Drugs Inc. is the series. And this particular segment takes a look at precisely how these organizations then have people working in areas around the country. In this case, you'll recognize the backdrop throughout the video, I'm sure.
This is the Mexican kingpins making millions for the cartels, who the police ultimately want to track down.
I'm in D.C. I'm the main guy. I'm the top guy. He's a chosen enemy. He's the other one that makes sure all the drugs out the way, make sure everybody can pay. I'm the charge of the enemy. The drug business is serious because this is where the enemy, people come to party here. We're going to have crystal meth, and we're going from Mexico. That's the issue.
Rodriguez isn't just trafficking meth into Vegas. He's also bringing in huge quantities of weed and cocaine.
We bring about $3 million worth of money. That's not the value of the drugs over here.
He pays half the money up front at wholesale prices. This goes directly to his bosses 300 miles away in Mexico.
Then when the money's out there, the drugs on the way, the stash and the cars, we put it inside the weed. When you cross the border, you don't get a thing. Only disappear to Las Vegas.
Once the drugs are trafficked to cross the border, the cartel uses San Diego as a distribution hub.
We're trying to help with the 3 cars. The main thing we do, we put a crystal truck. So that way, you know, the stuff for speed limit. We use your cell phone, we use our records. We use a radio strip, so that way it is faster. The driver is the one who gets the most risk. We don't use punch now, so that way they're going to be now 3 quarters. That's just for the scanning people what's going on. We do white people, black people, you know what I mean? If something happens, we're going to be connected. If they get stopped, when we take responsibility, our responsibility to be the lawyer, to bail them out.
As the kingpin, Rodriguez must be low-key to stay under police radar.
You have to change appearances here. I'll drive different cars. I know you're taking a house. I've got like 3-4 houses. I just spend this in this one. Sometimes I'm going all the way here. So, you know, pay attention, you know what I mean? That's how the drug people have to be. Sometimes you move to different states. We will say every 3 years, 4 years, you know, so we don't be hot. You don't go to jail. Nothing happens to you.
In the cartel, it is possible to move up the ladder, but only if you're delivering really big bucks.
The big thing for the cartel, but the regular guy, you go buy, that's why you go, you take steps, you know what I mean? Sometime in the year, I think you're the cartel about $10 million, you know what I mean? In the year.
With so much money at stake, there are grim consequences for anyone who dares to cross Rodriguez and his cartel.
The people who work for us, people close, you know, the family, we know who you are. And if one of our workers needs some house or whatever, you're going to pay for it. You're going to take your family away. It's just a wrap.
All right. We're going to talk amongst ourselves, to put it that way. I'd like to take advantage of the time we have to sort of get a chance to dialogue.
Yeah, I like to sit right up top. I think
Yeah. One thing watching that, and, you know, you see him talking about $3 million, $10 million. The money in this, it's just staggering. And that is an anecdote that came out of Los Angeles in the 90s or something. You know, some gang member was beat up because they couldn't move the cash fast enough that they had it in an apartment, and the rats ate $1 million worth of cash.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
Yeah.
And I'd like to take up sort of the images and that you evoked in the beginning of your talk, and also maybe you use them to contextualize the sort of human part of this, and the whole part that immigration plays in all of this. I reported for 9 years here in Las Vegas on immigration. And countless times I sat in households, just like you, and I'm sure yourself as well, with families that would lay out the same basic scenario where either it's a single mother or both parents working one or two jobs. In Las Vegas, it's the service industry or construction. Their absence from the household leaves the kids with little supervision, role model, and as the gangs that you mentioned that have come into the city over the last several decades proliferate, then in their neighborhoods, they're actually often initially a source of companionship and even some sort of affection almost that's missing in their household. And then after that, of course, there's money to be made as well. I don't know, it's interesting because in Las Vegas we've had a history of immigration that's so, and therefore so different compared to the two places that you live. I don't know if you'd like to talk about, you know, 100 years of seeing this scenario playing out in Southern California, and it's somewhat different in Tucson because, but anyway, you see, I mean, the lure of the drug trade for a poor kid if you're going up in the bayou is omnipotent. I mean,
right.
You know,
maybe he doesn't have a lot of choices. Now that's, and you know, you mentioned the family structure.
Right.
And you talk, I'll tell you, any gang member you talk to on the street will tell you that the gang is the family.
Right.
I mean, the word la familia in Spanish. I mean, the family is and the tragedy about that is that oftentimes a good immigrant family, we all came from immigrant families in the United States, we go back far enough, that family is left behind for the gang family.
Right.
And part of the tragedy here is that gang family is nothing but a dysfunctional family. Even though it might give a kid whose parents are at work all day a place to go, it's not a good place to go. Now you're going to ask what the solution is, and I don't always have that, you know. But it is a great American tragedy that we have thousands of kids. The FBI now says that every community in the United States with a population 250,000 or more has a bad gang problem. Now, I don't think that existed 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago. And what's even worse is I think that you see it, the gang thing on college campuses. You see it in middle-class communities.
Mm-hmm.
You even see it, you know, like on a campus like UCLA, so you see the tattoos, the baggy clothes, the shaved heads. You see that in upper middle class areas, and that all comes from the prison environment and the gang environment. But now it's a part of our culture. So I think it's more endemic today than it was in the days of Al Capone.
Mm-hmm. I want to address the recruitment pool problem. In Mexico, there are something that are called ninis, and it stands for ni trabajan ni estudian, and these are kids that neither work nor study. Anywhere from ages 9 to, you know, 17 or 18. The Mexican government estimates that there are maybe 300,000 or so ninis in Mexico, whereas NGOs, non-governmental organizations, are saying maybe as many as 7 million. So as Chris was and Tim were referring to, a lot of these kids come from either broken homes, moms that are working three jobs just to keep the family afloat, and these kids are just dropping out of school. Either that or it's too hard for them to go to school. For instance, in Ciudad Juarez, it's a city of like 2 million people. It's very spread out like L.A. Sometimes it's a three-hour trip to get the kid from home to school because they live in an outlying part of the city. And out like L.A. sometimes it's a three-hour trip to get the kid from home to school because they live in an outlying part of the city. And the way that the bus routes and public transportation work in Juarez, it's like a hub and spoke. So the kid's got to go from all the way over here, go to the center of the city, and then go to way over here just to go to a school. And obviously that's not real convenient. So you've got these kids that are 8, 9, 12 years old that are just sitting around with their friends on the street, bored, not doing a whole lot of anything. So then you've got a cartel member, lower level, that comes up to them and says, hey, if you, I'm going to give you a cell phone. Whenever you see an Army patrol coming, I want you to text me. And in return for that, you get to keep the cell phone, or I'll pay you $50, or I'll give you this, or this, and this, and this, and this. And you've got these kids, and they're called halcones, and they're lookouts, essentially. So then later on, when the kid becomes 12 years old, they graduate to being a drug mule, just moving small, you know, amounts, even within the country, just, you know, between communities, and then maybe later across the border. And then when he graduates to being 13, 14, 15, they give him $300, and they put an assault rifle in his hand, tell him to go into that restaurant and make sure that, you know, he shoots that guy. Well, he doesn't know exactly who that guy is, so he goes in there and he shoots everybody in the restaurant to make sure that he makes his, you know, it makes the extra $300 he's going to get for accomplishing the job. So you've got all these kids that look at these, you know, obviously they're going to be making a lot of money to get involved with the cartel. But also, it's hard to understand, with, and the best comparison that I can give you is the glamorization that occurs in Mexico with these kids. They look at these narco drug kingpins the same way that our kids and teenagers look at rock stars, at professional athletes, at you know, actors, et cetera. They see the money, they see the clothes, they see the girls and, the pimped out cars and the gold-plated guns, et cetera, and they worship these men, and they want to be just like them. They're glamorized in narcocorridos and these songs that are all about them, and telenovelas and the soap operas that glamorize this lifestyle. So you've got this enormous recruitment pool, and not only kids that are, you know, some of them are being involuntarily recruited into these gangs and threatened, but a lot of them, they aspire to that. So moving on from that, there, you know, news reports coming out, and this was some time ago, and you guys may have seen this, that there were cartels that were recruiting teenagers in Phoenix, in southern Arizona, in the poorest areas of the border. And there, trust me, there are a lot of poor communities along the southwest border. And these are kids who are U.S. citizens. They can come and go across the border. Some of them, you know, a lot of them may not have criminal records yet, but they've dropped out of school. They're already kind of in that pre-gang recruitment phase where they, you know, they're not going to go anywhere. Their grades are poor. They don't really have too many job opportunities because they have no skills. So here come these cartel guys and promising them all this money and glamour. But the added bonus for these kids that are recruited in southern Arizona and in other parts of the border is that they can come and go across the border legally because they're U.S. citizens. So it's not only happening there, but then you've got this huge pool of potential recruits that are U.S. citizens living right here in our border communities. So whether they're joining, you know, local gangs in L.A. or in Houston, or whether or not they're joining, you know, the cartel south of the border, it's a problem with poverty, with lack of educational opportunities, lack of job opportunities that spans both countries.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that you so with so much detail describe the situation in both sides of the border, and it brings to mind a point that often gets overlooked, you know, because there's not time to really go into the context and the details and the history behind this phenomenon in news media. And we were talking about this earlier. The cultural context, you know, to develop a drug manufacturing or growing and then trafficking enterprise, it takes a lot of, and the thing is that people here may overlook is that the socioeconomic context, right, in Mexico or where I reported from 20 years ago in Colombia, is so distinct from here because you grow up in a society where the we talk about wealth gap in the U.S., but wealth gap in Latin America is so abysmal that there really is, you know, most of the wealth in these many hands, and then there's everybody else, and there's not this idea that anybody can succeed based on education and so on, that you succeed if you have connections or a certain family name. So in that context, it's a lot easier, isn't it? Because you talked about the pull, the economic, but in that context, it's even easier, and it spreads even quicker, doesn't it? That the whole enterprise that you need to manufacture or grow, in the case of, you know, poppy for heroin or whatever, and then traffic.
It may seem almost trite, but there's much more opportunity here. I mean, even an immigrant kid who comes here, you know, if he did go on the straight, narrow path for some reason, he still has more opportunity here than he does. I mean, I was an tourist, and you go to these, what they call colonias, little villages, and there's like 7 or 8 year old kids running around with, you know, Mara Salvatrucha tattooed across their forehead and over their arms. I mean, it's unbelievable what kind of a future does a kid like that have. But what he sees is the only future he has there is a drug dealer.
Right.
You know, he wants to be like the 22-year-old guy. But I think
I'm going to cut it off there. Keep in mind that you can go to the locationbooktv.org and look at that book, Border Insecurity, by Sylvia Longmire. And here's the rest of the presentation. In fact, we're just about a third through it right there, but that's what we always do. And isn't it amazing in all this discussion so far, they don't mention fathers? They don't mention what the Mexican government should be doing about this? What's wrong with the people there? Why don't they do something about this and throw out these people? Why don't they have a revolution and get a real government? And I think about all this and these kids he just talked about that wearing the gang tattoos and the hats and all that business. And I mean, just think of it. And we got that Marine still locked up in prison down in Mexico. And our president of the United States hasn't done virtually anything to get him out of there. I'd shut down everything we got to do with Mexico until that Marine shows up in the United States. A Marine who served very well. His government. Anyway, that's it for this week. On the book talk phase, I'm going to recommend again Michael Savage's book, The Coming Civil War. And I think you will really enjoy that book, or How to Avoid the Coming Civil War. I think that's the title of it. Michael Savage's new book. I'm on the chapter on the war on the middle class, and it's really good. So it's his best work so far, and I've read all of them. We'll see you next week, and we'll have Vera Lynn sign us off.
We'll meet again. Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know? Tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. We'll meet again. Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.